everybody. Welcome back to the Bold Sidebar. This is your host, Jeff Horn, talking all things New Jersey Supreme Court. I am recording on July 16, 2021. We've got three cases, one unanimous case with fairly large implications to the entire jury selection process, and two other cases that are 4-3 splits. So we don't have that many of those to talk about. And then we've got some court news. Let's get right into the case that's making the news. And that is the public policy case dealing with bias in juror selection. So the case is called State v. Edwin Andujar, A-N-D-U-J-A-R. Let me just jump back for 2 seconds. In February, the court issued revisions to the model jury charges. So this would be the jurors are already in the box. They've already been selected. And now the jurors would be plied with open-ended questions so that they would utilize their best selves and try to overcome their own implicit biases, whether they be racial or otherwise. Back to the Andujar case, there are really two big findings, and I'll get to those right now. One is that the state is not permitted to conduct juror background checks without court approval, and the results of the juror background check approved by the court must be shared with the defense, and the juror has the right to respond. The other big holding is that the court ordered that this fall of 2021, that there will be a judicial conference on jury selection. And this is right from Chief Justice Ravner's opinion. This appeal highlights the critical role jury selection plays in the administration of justice. It also underscores how important it is to ensure that discrimination not be allowed to seep into the way we select juries. Potential jurors can be removed for cause if it appears they cannot serve fairly and impartially. The parties can also strike individual jurors without giving a reason by exercising peremptory challenges. Skipping down a bit, our understanding of bias and discrimination has evolved considerably since the 19th century, and federal and state law have changed substantially in recent decades to try to remove discrimination from the jury selection process. It is time to examine the jury selection process with the help of experts, interested stakeholders, the legal community, and members of the public, and consider additional steps needed to prevent discrimination in the way we select juries. The court cites to two big cases, U.S. Supreme Court Batson v. Kentucky and our New Jersey Supreme Court case, State v. Gilmore, both 1986 cases, both expressly banning any sort of discriminatory juror selection process. The case gained a lot of interest from AMICI, ACLU, Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, New Jersey Attorney General, and the Seton Hall School of Law Center for Social Justice. The Attorney General and the state argued that it was permissible for the state to conduct limited background checks on jurors based upon information. Now, let's talk about the juror in question. We only have initials. FG is the juror. The juror testified that he's got relatives in law enforcement. He's had relatives killed in criminal violent acts, homicide. Others have been involved with violent crime. This somehow provoked the state to conduct an overnight background check to determine that the juror had pending warrants from the Newark Municipal Court and actually arranged to have him arrested as opposed to a potential member of the jury pool. I think that really is an inciting piece of this policy determination. You know, we always say bad facts make bad law. Well, in this case, it seemed kind of sneaky for the state to run a background check on a guy after he had opened up about some of the interactions he had had with law enforcement and criminal justice through his family members, etc., run the background check, and then get him locked up. There's another bunch of facts which usually I lead with, but in this case, since it is a policy case, it is the court exercising its public policy role. But there are real humans involved here. Sometimes we lose track of that. The crime here that Mr. Andujar is alleged to have committed is in a roommate dispute that he stabbed 12 times his roommate, who was wheelchair bound. And when the police showed up, he was in possession of a bloody knife and stated, "I stabbed him. I couldn't take it anymore." So Mr. Andujar was convicted of murder, received a 42-year sentence that is now subject to a retrial because the court found that the juror selection process was tainted by the state's conduct. So the defendant gets a new trial. Who knows if it will have any impact on this particular defendant, but I just want to flip over the coin for the victim's family. Certainly it will have an impact on them. And we can only imagine that they would be among the aggrieved parties here with their case, their deceased relative, showing up as the victim of a very gruesome, horrible crime against a guy who's in a wheelchair. And yet, the policy designed to sort of free everyone from bias in the juror selection process. Interesting case. There'll be a commission. There'll be writings on this issue for sure. So you can stay tuned to that. Next case is another State v. State v. David Chavies, C-H-A-V-I-E-S. This is a 4-3 split with Justice Fernandez Vina writing for the majority, joined by Justices Patterson, Solomon, and Chief Justice Ravner. In dissent, Justice LaVecchia, joined by Justice Albin and Pierre Louis. This is another COVID-19 release case. We've talked about these a bunch of times. There's been a lot of litigation in 2020 and 2021 regarding releasing those that might have been exposed to a high degree of risk as a result of COVID and being in prison. Mr. Chavies is convicted of second degree aggravated assault as an accomplice in a murder. He gets a 10-year sentence, 85% required. He's got to serve 85% before he would be parole eligible based upon a number of factors, including a criminal history. When he goes in, he reports a range of serious medical conditions, including sickle cell anemia, asthma, others. It's not really disputed that he's got comorbidity factors for COVID. The court analyzed this case under the factors set forth in State v. Priester, P-R-I-E-S-T-E-R, and others, 1985 case. So here they go quickly. Serious nature of the defendant's illness, impact of incarceration on defendant's health, availability of medical services, and whether the condition will deteriorate or worsen while the defendant is in prison, whether the health circumstances have changed since the original sentence. And finally, to me, the wraparound, the high standard is whether the defendant would suffer a devastating impact on his health as a result of incarceration. So the standard is devastating impact. That sounds pretty darn extreme. The court, the majority, relied upon statutory requirements under the No Early Release Act and the court rules that address the circumstances under which a defendant can be released due to medical conditions. Here, it almost seemed a little speculative. Fortunately, the defendant didn't suffer perhaps as much as his risk factors would have indicated he might have during the COVID era, and the court denied his early release. The dissent, and frankly, the majority in dissent, do share some of the verbal sparring regarding this issue, with the majority essentially saying the dissent is asking the court to rewrite the statute, while the dissent, Justice LaVecchia, writing for the three dissenters, suggests that the procedure for considering an early release is well within the bounds of the Supreme Court's power as the rulemaker. So there's a court rule that deals with releasing someone based upon an extreme medical circumstance, and that the workaround would be to resentence a defendant so that if you resentence the base term and then apply the percentage required under the No Early Release Act, essentially you could shorten sentences, and that's all within the power of the Supreme Court. It's a close, obviously a close 4-3 ruling in favor of the state in this one. And Amici include ACLU, Attorney General's Office, County Prosecutors Association, and a group referred to as medical and public health experts. So that's an interesting case. Always interested to read the sparring between the majority and the dissenters. Third case, split decision, Coleman v. Martinez. Here are the players. Coleman works for DCPP. Martinez is a licensed social worker working for a DCPP mental health provider. And TE, initials Thomas Edward, is a client slash patient of both DCPP and Martinez's employer. 4-3 split in this case. The majority opinion is authored by Justice Solomon, joined by Justices Patterson, Fernandez-Vina, and Pierre-Louis. The dissent is authored by Justice Albin, joined by Chief Justice Rabner and Justice LaVecchia. T.E. is suffering significant mental health problems. She has 5 children. Her children are taken from her by DCPP. Her mental health issues are manifesting in delusional behavior, running out in the road, having hallucinations, reporting that she sees Jesus, and a wide range of mental health hardships. She's hospitalized, and then she needs to go back to the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist writes an order essentially having TE go back to the psychiatrist as soon as possible. Martinez, who appears to be in charge of TE's care, does not get TE back to the psychiatrist in a timely fashion. Instead, TE goes to the DCPP office after having spoken to Coleman some days previously and apparently communicated with Martinez, and stabs Coleman at the DCPP office 22 times, causing significant injuries. Coleman sues Martinez essentially on a foreseeability claim, failure to warn that this behavior, this violent behavior, was foreseeable. Martinez defends under a number of bases, including that she doesn't have a duty to warn, that there were no specific threats from TE to Coleman, and that TE may be eligible for immunity under a statute, NJSA 62A-16. Remember, I said that Martinez is a licensed social worker, distinct from a licensed clinical social worker. Well, the statute lists licensed clinical social worker as an immune party when one of their patients or clients commits a violent act against another. Licensed social workers, however, are not included in the statute. And eventually, that's essentially conceded. It's simple language of the statute. We'll get to this when we talk about the dissent. The court finds that there is enough to overturn summary judgment ordered below, as Martinez failed to refer TE back to the psychiatrist and therefore back on her medications, that it was foreseeable that TE, suffering significant mental health issues and hallucinations, could be a danger, and therefore Martinez had a duty to warn. Also importantly, Martinez identified Coleman as a source of information regarding TE's hallucinations. This apparently contributed to setting her off on her violent course. The dissent essentially says that Martinez, a licensed social worker, should be afforded the immunities set forth in NJSA 62A-16, that it's more of a slip of the pen rather than a substantive decision made by the legislature and or the governor at the time, Governor Florio, when the statute was enacted. So, but for a little tinkering with the language that immunizes LCSW as well as psychologists, psychiatrists, all other range of regulated mental health professionals are all protected, except the licensed social worker is not protected. So that gives rise to the 4-3 split, with Justice Halvin saying, kind of crying out for a common sense application of the law. The majority said, no, we narrowly view statutes that provide for immunity. And in this case, the LSW does not enjoy the immunity that the cousin LCSW would otherwise enjoy. So that case is headed back for a jury trial. Now for the news. Three quick pieces of news. The court has addressed 88,000 marijuana cases and dismissed those. The court has addressed the landlord-tenant dilemma, where we've got thousands and thousands of landlord-tenant actions that are about to land in the courthouse, providing for procedures to administratively address those, created a new form, sort of a case information statement for landlord-tenant cases, and adopted a range of remedies to hopefully smooth out the coming flood of landlord-tenant cases. And last but not least, in terms of the news, exciting news, August 2nd, the courthouses are open. You do not need an appointment to go to the courthouse, including folks that just want to go and stroll in and watch proceedings. The courthouse is back open. 75% of staff will be allowed in the building, 100% in early September. This does not mean all cases will be adjudicated in the courthouse. Indeed, back to our landlord-tenant matters, that procedure expressly states these matters should be addressed virtually as much as possible. So there's still a lot of finessing to do in terms of reopening the courthouse to all manner of disputes, but it's excellent progress. 75% in August, 100% of staff in September, and we'll see when us lawyers and litigants and so forth will be invited back to apply our trade there. All right, that's it. As usual, I very much appreciate all of my guests. I've had such fantastic guests lately. If you didn't get a chance to listen to Alexander Shalom, Bruce Greenberg, to me, you really missed something, so jump back to all the shows from 2021 where we're talking all things New Jersey Supreme Court. If you've got a case that's headed there, been there, one of the cases I spoke with about with the Bruce Greenberg was a case that went up and now it's back down to the trial court, and who knows if we'll see it again. But I'm absolutely eager to talk to you, so get in touch. Thanks for listening to the Bold Sidebar.